it's a currency. Swear not at all, but I curse. Thine enemy is none the worse. A church on Sunday to attend would serve to keep the world thy friend. Honor thy parents, that is all, for whom advancement may befall. Thou shalt not kill, but needs not strive officiously to keep alive. Do not adultery commit, if any, rarely comes of it. Thou shalt not steal an empty feat when 'tis so lucrative cheap. Bear not false witness, let the lie have time on its own wings to fly. Thou shalt not covet, but tradition approves all forms of competition.
It has a lot of great things.
It really does.
It's a jingle, isn't it?
But who can say that it's not true?
What's it?
Clough, the British poet, say not the struggle not availeth, you know, that's one of his more famous ones. The new Decalogue.
Okay.
Well, we didn't get around to seeing any of the more, not exactly traditional, but more traditional approaches to Christ and poetry. And I suppose it would be good to look at a couple of those now from Gerard Manley Hopkins. Let's see. Keep them all straight, even. This is called The Soldier. It's sonnet number 40 by Hopkins from period 1876 to 1889. Yes, why do we all, seeing of a soldier, bless him, bless our red coats, our tars, both these being the greater part but frail clay, nay, but foul clay. Here it is, the heart. Since proud it calls the calling manly, gives a guess that hopes that makes believe the men must be no less. It fancies, feigns, deems, dares the artist after his art, and fain will find him as sterling all as all the smart, and scarlet where the spirit of war there express. Mark Christ our King. He knows war, serve this soldiering through. He of all can reeve a rope best. There he bides in bliss now, and seeing somewhere some man do all that man can do. For love he leans forth, needs his neck must fall on his, and cry, O Christ done deed, so God made flesh does too. Were I ere come again, cries Christ, it should be this. What is that poem? It's got the military image in it and the Christ image. What is that poem trying to do? I'll read the paragraph about Christ. Mark Christ, our King. He knows war. Serve this soldiering through. He of all can reap a rope best. There he bides in bliss now, and seeing somewhere some man do all that man can do. For love he leans forward, needs his neck must fall on kiss and cry, O Christ done deed, so God made flesh does too. Were I come o'er again, cries Christ, it should be this. Can I say?
War is the re-crucifixion.
I suppose that could be in the background here. But what specifically is he saying about Christ? The soldiering is a just a background here, and it's taken less in the sense of violence and warfare than as a profession. You know, he might have used some other profession as a background here. Or maybe one other profession wouldn't be as colorful. What's he saying? Mark Christ our King. In other words, here's how you can see what Christ really means. Now I'm seeing somewhere some man do all that man can do. For love, he leans forward. Needs his neck must fall on kiss and cry, O Christ done deed. What you saying? He's saying that Christ would make excuse for people, just as in the first paragraph we saw the difference between the red coats and, you know, the whitewash on the belt, shiny belt buckle, and underneath there's not only frail clay, but actually foul clay, referring to, you know, the common soldier and sailor. But for the sake of the fact that even this weak, pale clay exists to be tested, and in a sense we kind of feel sorry, and at the same time kind of feel some nobility in these very human beings, we make excuse for them. He says Christ would do the same thing. Do you see that? He's making an excuse between the outside and the inside. Yeah, Christ leans forward. You get a kind of an idea of Christ leaning off the cross, you know, leaning forward in love to inquire about his mother or, you know, or John or something like this. He knows war, serve this soldier. And through war here, the soldier's art is a paradigm, it's a model of life, you know, which we go through life. And there's a difference between the exterior and the interior. And everybody, every profession, every man, woman. Now seeing somewhere some man do all that man can do. In other words, if he sees a need, and the need to be forgiven, the need to be excused for the difference between the pretension and the actuality, you know, that's a real need. Maybe it's the most basic of need. And seeing this, and he gives exactly this kind of affirmation. For love, he leans forward. Needs his neck must fall on, which is Hopkins, you know, he has what he calls sprung rhyme in a very ornate poetic style. In other words, he falls on a person's neck, kisses him, and cries, O Christ done deed. So God made flesh does too. This is what Christ does. Were I e'er come o'er again, cries Christ, it should be thus. In other words, sometimes you get very moral or religious and we talk about not making the excuses and we talk about hypocrisy and pretension and so forth. But what he's implying is that this is exactly the kind of thing Christ did and would do. And he equates Christ with the Christ done deed, which means in a sense accepting a person even though there's a difference between the exterior and the interior. Giving, overlooking them.
I still think of Paul's phrase there where the Christ has been crucified afresh. The agony within the human heart is type of suffering and pain that's related to the cross.
Yes, that certainly would be a background here. I'm sure it would be in the case of Hopkins.
Right.
In other words, a Christ none deed, as Paul puts it, I think, in one of the lessons he talked about his suffering, filling up what was wanting in the suffering of Christ. In other words, it adds to it. And makes it complete, right. And that's part of it. But the suffering that he has in view here is not what we think of in melodramatic terms of battle and pain and things of this nature, but the interior suffering of knowing the difference between the pretension and the actuality. the difference here between the red coat and the tar and the blue jacket and so forth. The dirt is covered up with white shoe polish. The dirty socks that you can't see. The backs of the shoes that aren't polished. The brave front, you know. The sour smell underneath the red coat. This kind of thing, you know, which is itself a kind of a parable for actually what we are inside and what we put ourselves out to be and may actually think we are. That's kind of a suffering too, which may be at the root of a lot of the evil we do to each other, not being able to live with that.
But you said something, you know, Christ excuses this.
Yeah, that's what that's the implication I get out of this. He excuses you, forgives you for this.
I like the word forgive better.
I think maybe it means the same thing though, you know, if I excuse you for a faux pas, I forgive you. It's according to the language. We don't like the word excuse, right?
Yeah.
But he does, you know.
The word excuse, I suppose, does not have the connotation of man's repentant attitude and so forth, but that's understood, I think.
Yeah, but on the other hand, we use the word excuse every day, and we don't use the word forgive every day. So it could be that at this point in time, excuse is a stronger word, although I agree, you know, it certainly doesn't have the word to death. It's darker.
Basically, you need to have that repentant attitude. Maybe God knows you have it.
That may be.
Externally, excuse might be an adequate word if the thing is understood there by God.
Don't we say excuse me with so little meaning so often?
Yeah, that's probably true. I wonder if we don't use forgive in an even meaningless, more meaningless way though. For example, the expression, I'll forgive you but I won't forget, which of course is
contradiction.
It's a contradiction because the forgive is in the Bible, when it used the metaphorical language about God, it says he puts them behind him. Back as far as the east is from the west, forgets about it.
Yeah, John,
don't forgive them. Yeah.
I think that's an unhuman act. However.
How's this now?
Well, I don't. That anthropomorphism, I don't really think it's valid.
Mm-hmm.
You and I are built for remembering. Forgiveness may culminate eventually, and if it's a sincere thing, in us forgetting. Or maybe it just takes the passion or the emotion out of the deed.
As a description of what we really are like as human beings, you're exactly correct. But I think it also points out the fact that we really don't participate in forgiveness. It's very difficult to do this. Remembering, of course, is something that's selective, you know, to speak psychologically. We remember what we want to remember, whether we're conscious or not of it. And we remember that which touches us most deeply. And this business of not being able to forgive, or forget rather, in the forgiving means that, you know, we want to cling to that. It gives us some kind of a satisfaction or something. It's a mark of not complete repentance. Speaking as an average human being, we certainly regret. But it's an interesting thing that corporations and nations and even enemies, in the larger sense of the word, like social forces and things, do a better job of forgetting than individual human beings do. For example, the enemies in one war may be the allies in another 5 years later. It actually happens. And they forget officially. They have to. We've got to work together, you know? And that we don't do this in our individual lives is another mark of this difference between the pretension and the actuality. But it itself shows that the forgiveness is not genuine. It may sound unhuman, and yet the implication, not in this poem, because this goes beyond this poem only has its one lesson, I suppose. But the implication is that until we are of such a kind that we can give up, you know, the satisfaction of remembering how we've been done dirty by, and even greater satisfaction of how we, you know, very magnanimously forgave, that we haven't really participated in forgiveness. It is possible to forget, and it's difficult to remember something that doesn't have great importance for us.
And this is what I meant, it takes the emotion out of it.
Yeah, in other words, even a weak form of forgiveness has the advantage of saying you no longer are striking at each other, or maybe using vile language or something like that. But it's still not complete.
Now, this is belaboring, I know.
Yeah, go ahead, it's really important, and you're exactly right.
I think that we really do our people an injustice. You know, I think we make them carry around a whole bag that they really shouldn't have to carry around.
But that's what memory is, though, this bag, yeah. You're talking about the remembering.
Yep. What I'm saying, I'm thinking about a sense of guilt over not having forgotten. Tielicker says that forgiving is saying, because I love you, we go on.
Mm-hmm. And but we don't go on remembering. I don't think he would imply that.
No. But it doesn't happen.
Okay, maybe it doesn't.
And,
I don't know.
By saying, I forgive you. And sincerely meaning it. You know, as completely as a person is able. In a most intimate relationship. A husband and wife.
Yep. Now you're getting on something that is in the poem, and it would be good to see this again. This forgiveness, or whatever it is, called acceptance, I mean, that's a common word today. Maybe it's one of, like, that we've overused, but I guess this would fit in here. It isn't just a word when he goes to Christ saying, I forgive you, or, you know, even thinking, I forgive you, or something like this. It says, now and seeing somewhere some man do all that man can do, for love he leaps forth, needs his neck must fall on kiss and cry. In other words, forgiveness really is certainly not genuine or isn't complete if it's only verbal or only mental. It ushers in action. And that's where the forgetting perhaps becomes important. Because acting, as we know, you know, sets up new neural pathways, it sets up new memories, you know, and this sort of thing, which crowd out the old. What was it, Spurgeon, the great preacher, one of them said, the compulsive power of a new affection. The expulsive and compulsive power. Doing something else pushes the old out, pushes it back. If it doesn't usher, you know, sometimes, too, forgiveness is a sort of a truce, a standoff. You know, we forgive, but we're very careful because we don't want to get back in the same kind of situation again. And, of course, then that memory is going to stand. There isn't anything impressed down over again. It takes more experience. Take two nations that have been at war or something. Well, if they said, well, you know, every time we get together, we blow each other up, we just keep apart. Naturally, there's no more shared experience after this. Maybe this is one of the ultimate hang-ups of a divorce, even though it may be necessary by everything that we can see and know, but that it separates it apart and freezes that memory right at that point. Whereas if you can go on living over the turmoil and the trouble and the agony, you can build on top of it new experiences. As he says here, Christ falls on the man's neck and kisses him. This is a new experience. there's even a symbol of this when we apologize to each other, which is an everyday way of forgiving. We shake hands, you know, it's a physical action, something like that.
Well, I was going to say that I think this is implied in the story of the prodigal son. The experience has not all been forgotten, but it has been forgiven, and they build upon that which is. And I think sometimes we're just kidding ourselves, because everything is forgotten, but it's not held in bitterness, but you build upon it and use it, and you turn evil into good.
Yeah.
And then the part to forget becomes not important. In this way, it is.
Can it actually be a help?
Forgotten.
That's right.
It can't necessarily, you still have a convolution on your gray matter that remembers it, but it isn't important to you anymore. It's
you don't go selecting it out every time you meet that individual. That's important, right?
Well, I was thinking you mentioned nations,
yeah.
And it's a sort of a dishonesty that nations have that they can forget these tremendous passions. Maybe the more honest nations are the Arabs and the Jews that have these intense antagonisms that they never forget, or the Greeks and the
Persians.
The Greeks and the
Turks.
I mean. It is real interesting. I'm associated with Greek and Turkish doctors with me, and you can tell this is transmitted as an inherited thing almost. They almost have their DNA changed, I think, someplace that's done this.
It may be more honest, passionately speaking, but I mean measured by the upshot of suffering and continued blood and evil.
Oh, it's bad.
It's evil. It really is evil. Yeah. In a sense, you know, the whole idea of forgiveness in the Bible implies that God participates in a white lie. Let's look at it that way. You know, he treats the unjust man as if he were just. There's a real question about honesty. Truth, and I've never been able to get a definition of truth better than this one, truth is a fact plus love. It's not just a fact. So it's been interpreted, you see. And you say, oh, this is pretense, and pretense is not real, but whatever else in the world is real. Even our so-called facts and our honesty itself shares an intention and persuasion and this sort of thing. The way we approach
Germans. And yet, look at that movie last night that they showed.
I didn't see that, but that was on Merrill, probably, isn't it?
The one before that, it was your eyes.
Oh, yeah. The one about the Arabs or the Israelis or something?
Oh, that's what I had the impression it was supposed to be, but not. So it was the concentration camps and the...
Well, these were concentration camps in Israel, though.
No, it was Dachau. Well,
I didn't see the first part of that.
It's pretty gory.
Mm-hmm. But we haven't forgiven completely, then, if we keep digging things up like this. Now, I can see the Jews keep remembering things like this. But is there the need for the rest of us to show things like this?
Aren't these just used as goads to conscience? Our conscience.
It may well be, yeah.
And you can say, well, we weren't the ones that were perpetrating the atrocities.
Well,
the Germans are doing
what are we doing to the Negro?
Building themselves on it, from what I understand.
Yeah, that's a real problem. I suppose now that here you're talking about something that's almost cosmic, you know, and it's impressed, something so huge, you know, it really transcends the individual, and yet that we can't get out of it that easily either. There's been a whole lot made of that. For one thing, it makes very interesting preaching. And makes very interesting books, and we all have a sort of a fascination for it, I suppose. It may even reveal something weak or sick about us, but all human beings do have a fascination with it. even if they were repelled by it, that's a, another form of the fascination.
We call it entertainment, then, we do.
I wouldn't call it entertainment so much as saying that, in a sense, it's almost as if we wonder what the inside of man is like as something, and it's almost like here's a big scooped out hole and you can really see down into the deep dark recesses, and so it does fascinate. That it may entertain in some way may also be true. I don't think that's the basic thing.
What would be the opposite, though? We just ignore it and forget and forgive and well, not learn from past experience?
The reason I said it's kind of cosmic, it's kind of large and individual. Obviously, we can't forget it as a historical action. And history is made up of events, something like that, and other events, some of them more pleasant, to be sure. Here, I think the difference would be made when someone says this is exemplary or this is to bear in mind these kind of conditions brought upon this kind of a problem. Educational, if you will, the idea also, the universality of it, you know, this wasn't done just because the Germans were Germans, but because any group of people, when they are affected in such and such ways and they feel that they must do such and such things to better themselves or something else, are prey to fall into these kinds of ultimately evil terms. And it could happen here. I was talking, I believe, to you, sir, the other night about the placard that I saw out at the Walker Art Institute, Twin Cities, the other day. And it was all about George Wallace's campaign. It was made up of the clippings from the paper lately, and over it was this title, and it had a sort of a shadowy picture of Adolf Hitler. It says, "The bitch that bore him is in heat again." And anybody that can look at the United States in the last 20 years and not see the same kind of thing that developed after 1919 in Germany is really blind, because the parallels are fairly obvious and they're getting closer to the surface all the time. Now, that isn't a question of not forgiving the Germans and even the Jews for feeling very, very bitter about this. It isn't a question of forgiving at this point. It's a question of common sense, you might say, of learning by history, because again, these things are all proverbs and maybe weak, and yet they reveal something. Those who do not study history are condemned to repeat its mistake. Forgiveness is not an issue here. Moral progress might be.
Is this not what you have in the Agape Feast or the Passover?
Yeah.
You see, they remembered Egypt. They would never let that be forgotten, their mistake and the slavery and all that. And yet, remember, God was in the picture too.
This is right, and it becomes stereotyped, of course, in that story. It's Pharaoh, you know. It isn't the Egyptians as such, although unfortunately this kind of a thing happens in people's lives that they can see with these racial hatreds and so forth. But it was paradigmatic. It was an example, if you will. You know, you can use this as a guide to measure the present and maybe to predict the future. A real difference. In a way, you know, to use the, and give me a good out, because you don't know what to do when you bring up this thing about the Jewish question and the final solution. You really don't. Anybody that says he does, I think, is lying to himself and others. But when you bring up the question of the Exodus, well, we've had several thousand years now, maybe about 3,200, to digest that. You might not completely understand it yet. But in the text of the Old Testament itself, as I remember the years when I was studying the Old Testament, there's even an apology for Pharaoh, that Pharaoh did what he did because the Spirit of God was on him, that he couldn't help himself, you know. God hardened his heart, which is a way of the people who recorded that, and I guess that section of the Bible was put down in writing about 900 or 1,000 years before Christ. They were considerably closer to the event which happened in the 1300s BC than we are. I've got an exact date, I think 1284 or something is one of the better accepted dates for the Exodus. People much closer to the event are already seeing that something of a cosmic significance like this was not to be attributed perhaps just to human misery, and to therefore would justify it in remembering it and hating and never forgiving and this sort of thing. But they saw that there was some larger purpose in it, and so Pharaoh really is excused. And he comes off a rather pitiful figure for whom you feel sorry. He's standing there, as it were, in the court holding the dead body of his son. And the question of death and the death of the firstborn always is a symbol of atonement, of forgiveness. So that if some kind of a symbol, some kind of a faith confrontation over that terrible tragedy of the Second World War could ever come into being, maybe that too, finally, without excusing anything that was due to human malignancy, but recognizing that some things are larger than individuals in their decisions, it might take on a healthier thing, because now the Passover feast is a healthy thing, something that builds community. Something that grew up and embraced not only the people of Israel, but it embraced the stranger, you know, and all other men. It took on a universal aspect. And in Christianity, in the Eucharist, it takes on an even more intensely universal aspect. Because finally, what is wrong with this business of not forgetting and of harboring feelings that we've been done dirty and so forth, is that it is so individual that it forgets the other person, and it forgets something that the history of ethics and religion teaches us so clearly, and that is that those who do evil to others are themselves evilly done by. The evil cuts both ways. And also forgetting too that the essence maybe of sinfulness is partiality. It's separating out. It's this selectivity, this exclusiveness, ultimately, that magnifies the differences among people. Even the differences, and this is an interesting thing, where the New Testament is absolutely unethical, looked at from the philosophical, ethical point of view. Like Aristotle wants distributive justice, everything equal and according to its due. The New Testament cuts down and undercuts the whole difference between the sinner and the righteous. There's absolutely no difference. So that little blasphemous song that one of the boys was singing yesterday morning about, you know, Jesus hanging out with pimps and prostitutes and, you know, and things like this. This is actually the case. And this is very difficult still for us to understand after 2,000 years of Christian teaching, that the differences make no difference. And if you want to say excuse, we think of the person who makes excuses and asks for excuses as weak. And yet it is maybe the weak things that can endure because it feels the full end.
But that is a real excuse. But when we stop by saying Jesus making out pimps and prostitutes, we only told half the story.
Yes, that may be true, but I wonder sometimes what the other half of the story is. You know, Jesus didn't get to complete it. A lot of the other half of the story has been supplied by people who maybe didn't understand Jesus. What was the other half of the story? You know, what really was it? That he changed them is obvious. You know, that's obvious.
What happened to the ones he didn't change?
Yeah, what happened to the ones he didn't change? Well, this is the point. This is the question. How can we say? What happens to the ones of us that he doesn't change, whether we're pimps or prostitutes or physicians or philosophers, you know, since there really is no difference? I don't know. It may be, too, that something of this is reflected in the gospel story, that there probably exists more tolerance between people on the very bottom of the ethical barrel than at the top. You know, like a prison, where sometimes a lot of differences do come in. I understand some kinds of prisoners just have a conceived hatred for others, sex perverts, for example, or something like this, and they sometimes murders take place in prison. But by and large, you know, the perjurer and the embezzler and the thief and the murderer, at that point, by and large, there's acceptance and tolerance. There has to be, you know. There really has to be. The judgment has been passed. You know, the law has done its work. And you can say that theologically as well as legally. Maybe it was that kind of a tolerance, which you also find among these weak reeds in uniforms, you know, that the man referred to in this, that doesn't magnify differences. Maybe that is why Jesus was able to move and work at those times. Pretty obviously, he wasn't a person of this kind himself. He was one who must have sat around the synagogue studying the Bible a lot from his language, and he was interested in this kind of thing. And yet it's kind of amazing that the only ones that his message apparently reached, with few exceptions, were of this bottom of the barrel type, because the distinctions weren't very great. They can't be. It's something about all being covered with mud, you know, that knocks down the distinctions among men.
Well, and there's something about being in that situation, too. The 1st of May, I was in San Francisco, where they have this large homosexual population. And sitting talking to some of these people, one, a girl of 22, and of her concern, not only, and not anymore for sexual or you know, or sex fulfillment, but a kind of honest concern that just overwhelmed me, and I longed to have her in my congregation. I thought that she could be a tremendous example to about 95% of my people in terms of concern for others, and especially those around her of her kind. And I think that when they've been thrown down into this Tenderloin area, and this is what they have, is each other. You know, once in a while, a curious creature wanders in there on a program or something.
In other words, if Jesus had come wandering up from Galilee, he probably could have sat down there too, yeah. This is a little poem from a modern poet now, Ferland Getty. It's not precisely on the target, yet it illustrates what we've been talking about, because of the fact that we kind of make Christ and Christ-like imagery and hope unavailable to people because we have kind of made distinctions. There are 222 denominations in this country alone, and the number is down considerably. That's not counting Catholic. They were putting up the statue of St. Francis in the front of the church of St. Francis in the city of San Francisco, in a little side street just off the avenue where no birds sang. And the sun was coming up on time in its usual fashion, and just beginning to shine on the statue of St. Francis, where no birds sang. And a lot of old Italians were standing all around on a little side street just off the avenue, watching the wily workers who were hoisting up the statue with a chain and a crane and other implements, and a lot of young reporters in button-down clothes were taking down the words of one young priest who was propping up the statue with all his arguments. And all the while no bird sang any St. Francis passion, and while the lookers kept looking up at St. Francis with his arms outstretched to the birds who weren't there, a very tall and very purely naked young virgin with very long and very straight straw hair and wearing only a very small bird's nest in a very existential place kept passing through the crowd all the while and up and down the steps in front of St. Francis, her eyes downcast all the while and singing to herself. Like hanging Jesus' picture up, you know, in prison or something, using the blessed execution. Here's St. Francis where no birds are. You know, propping him up with a crane and with arguments, and, you know, the city of San Francisco. Because maybe Francis was one of the very few fools in history that really interpolated the Christ-like attitude of what Christ was like to history. And of course, he was exactly a fool. The Pope and everybody else recognized that. We're kind of skeptical about him. He did all sorts of silly things, very unhygienic, you know, as well as other things. And yet, you know, it wasn't very important to him that you put up statues or build buildings or even give money, but just sort of walk around and affirm people. And he always himself sought out the people in the worst condition. He was condemned, as an interesting thing, even centuries ago for being unscientific and unhygienic, because his first mission was going over and fooling around with the lepers. He probably spread a little leprosy and so forth, although I understand it's difficult to do when you were with it as close as Francis were. It was, it's probably a little bit more possible. But he was a very existential kind of person. He was there on the spot. No birds sang. Yeah, sometimes, you know, we use Jesus in the Christ symbol. And this is the whole thrust of so much of the poetry and the radical thought. Just the opposite way he would be used. Let's see what poem number 34 is before the bell rings when we go drink coffee.
Bell
ring. Did it already ring for coffee?
Mm-hmm.
It's early today then. Okay.
Read the poem. Coffee.
Now let's go.
Read. Read the poem?
Oh, okay. You want me to? Let me see now.
She's reading today.
Page 30. Okay. This is the wind hoover and the ideas of a falcon that's soaring, you know, in the air to Christ our Lord. I caught this morning's minion kingdom of daylight's doffing, dapple dawn drawn falcon in his riding, of a rolling level underneath him steady air and striding. Hi there, how he rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy, then off forth on swing, as a skate's heel sweeps smooth on a bow bend, the hurl and gliding, rebuff the big wind, my heart in hiding, stirred for a bird, the achievement of the mastery of the thing. Brute beauty and valor and act, O air, pride, plume, here buckle, and the fire that breaks from thee then a billion times told lovelier, more dangerous, O my cavalier. No wonder of it, share clod makes plow down sillion shine, and blue bleak embers, ah, my dear, fall, gall themselves, and gash gold vermilion. There's two images in that poem. First is the soaring bird, the falcon, and the second is a plow cutting through the soil in the last. And it is dedicated to Christ, who is mentioned only once when he says, "Oh, my cavalier," that is my, you know, savior on horseback coming in. And it is actually an illustration of what we're talking about, the humbleness of Christ, you know, the fact Christ has no pride. You know, that's what he really great says. He really has no pride. Absolutely none. And no integrity either. If you think about the way that we think about integrity, you know, understand. And no patriotism or any of these other big things. And so at first he has the traditional thing about Christ, although in language that nobody could ever catch up with. Christ is like this great falcon, great, strong bird soaring over man and over history, and just inspires us and draws us on, you know, the traditional piety and the brute beauty of it. But then, oh my cavalier, Hopkins remembers that he has misjudged what Christ is. No wonder of it. Of course we're moved by the beauty of something like that, soaring in flight and free and high above our heads. But he reminds us that what we see there is beyond us and doesn't touch us, that we're creatures of the earth. And the beauty is there on the earth, in the mud, just as well as in the soaring bird. And in the language here is even more beautiful. Share plod makes plow down psyllium shine. Just every day plodding along. It's something that was as commonplace 100 years ago, it isn't now. It's plowing up a garden. When the plow cuts through the loam, you know, and it's thrown up shining and smooth. And blue leaf embers, ah, my dear, fall when the embers burst up and fall down, as we've seen it in this fire here. Gall themselves and gash gold for me. The true beauty and the beauty and the inspiration that has something to say to man is not the beauty of the soaring bird. It's not that which is high, but that which is close to us, and in a more simpler day, as every day in common, is plowing and as a fire burning. And it's here that we look for the image of Christ. This is what he's saying. The wind tuber is not Christ, not the soaring bird. And that's illustrated by the subtitle, which says, "To Christ our Lord." Christ is the shine of the dirt thrown up by the plow. He is the gold vermilion sheen of the flames, you know, as they die. Yeah.
The person only has this concept of Christ, but devoid of humility, devoid of nationalistic aspirations and all this and that.
No, not devoid of humility, yeah. Full of humility.
I mean, yeah, full of humility, yeah. Devoid of nationalism and all that. Mm-hmm. Okay, is there a redemptive power within?
Well, that's the only time there is a universal redemptive power. Otherwise, he's a partial symbol.
But isn't there something about the heavenly messenger in him too?
Yeah, but this is precisely it. He is the revealer of the divine in our midst.
Now, but I mean, if you just put it on the earthy level and not bring that in, there's something like it.
There may well be, but there's more lacking when he's the bird flying around with no touch to the earth. You see, and this, unfortunately, has been the mistake of Christianity, not the others.
No.
Not that we have made him too human and too earthy and too humble, but that we have made him too high and too proud and hence unavailable. Now, if the mistake had run the opposite way, then indeed, you know, maybe the poetic tradition and the radical tradition in general would have the opposite message, because you're right. it isn't these saying, you know, look at the mud and be content with mud and be content with being on the bottom of the ethical barrel. Not at all. But understand, that's just where we are, and that's really what the problem is. It's always beautiful, you know, to go galloping off in all directions to fight imaginary foes, or foes that we have made because of imaginary slights. It's easier to fight a holy war than it is to try to, you know, reconstruct the earth.
What about here? What about the areas where you, the Bible, for instance, where you talk about the narrow way, the few and the thin, all the fighting, the good fight, body making. This is a big
right.
Thing.
And it's all very earthy metaphor, too, at that point, you know. He said he has the contrast not of the soldier, but of the athlete who buffets his body and subdues it. And he implies then, you know, although the other kind of imagery is there, because we remember Christianity came up in a time and a place when this spiritual metaphor and this kind of language was the language of religion, but the contrast is that there's so little of it in Christianity compared to other religious forms, and there's so much of the humble and the human and the dirt, if you will, because the idea is my fight, although Paul talks about principalities and powers, you know, and the spiritual things, like the wind hoover here, like the bird, that's in Paul. There's no gainsaying. But that there is in him, when he gets right down to the nitty gritty, as we might say, he says, no, the battle's not out there with all these spiritual powers and these big ideals and everything, but it's right here in Paul of Tarsus. And I beat my body and I subdue it. It's right here in me. And it's right here among my people and in the earth. This is where the fight really is. These other things are metaphorical. Now, he never says that, but I mean, the implication is that I beat my body lest, having preached to others, I myself should become a castaway. Less than using all of this big metaphor, I get to believe that that's a literal fact, you know, a literal statement, and forget, no, the real struggle is here with me in the breaking of my pride. Because Paul's a beautiful example of that. That's exactly what happened to him on the Damascus Way.
He's
broke. Get the coffee. Tonight at 6:30, we'll execute.